Lecture 8. Bronte, Wuthering Heights, Part 1.
As I talk about Wuthering Heights in this lecture, I'd like you to bear in mind what I said earlier about the Bildungsroman, the one that the form that we see so clearly in Balzac. Because the Bildungsroman, even when it's cynical, as it is in Balzac, or if it's tragic, I think is a reassuring form, because it means that somebody learns something. Rastignac does learn something. He learns what happened to Goriot. Education is possible. Society may finally be seen as evil, but it can be understood. But there could be other views of the world, darker, less amenable to sweet reason, more unhinging. And I think that's what Wuthering Heights is. Wuthering Heights was for me an important decision for this course, because one could have easily chosen Charlotte Bronte's book, Jane Eyre, which is, I think, a more recognized major novel of the 19th century. And Charlotte, the older sister to Emily, wrote a book about maturation. It really is a Bildungsroman. It's about accommodation. It's about Jane overcoming obstacles and moving ever more firmly and impressively into adulthood and selfhood. Emily, who died quite young, Emily's book, Wuthering Heights, is fierce. It's fiercer than anything else we're going to look at in this course. It depicts a world that is extraordinarily primitive, dark, unmanageable, and it can make, by contrast, much of what we've seen seem prim or superficial or not really delving under the surface. So that a lot of the operative terms that we use and that people have always used, such as reason versus emotion, etc., they won't take us very far in this book, because reason doesn't have any purchase in this book. And emotion or passion is something that can't be corralled in this book. It seems to be the wellspring of being. It seems to be allied to the natural elements themselves. And this is a book about the natural elements. It seems to make a mockery of our notion of civilization, which comes across as something like a papier-mâché construct, a dollhouse, having little relationship to the actual organic, fierce, dark forces that roil both in the world and in the human subject. One grid that may help us make some sense of this book is the set of terms used by the anthropologist Levi-Strauss. He wrote a book called The Raw and the Cooked, and even though there's not much interest in food in Wuthering Heights, The Raw and the Cooked signify, for the anthropologist, a world of sort of unprocessed feelings and passions and emotions, a primitive world on the one hand. It can be used to describe perhaps some tribal cultures, or at least the origins of some tribal cultures. And then at the other end, as the very project of civilization, the cooked. In other words, what we take with raw ingredients that we have, let's go back to the culinary model, and we produce cuisine, we produce food. This is really the process, the project of civilization. That really might, in fact, help us to see what's happening in this book. As I said, education, you could claim, is moving from the raw to the cooked. Education means to get a handle on things, to be able to see how things fit or how they might be made to fit, to impose, if not to discover, some form of order. The title of this book, and the other place that's the contrast to the title, epitomizes these notions of raw versus cooked. Wuthering Heights is the kind of raw, primitive place in the moors where this story originates, and I think arguably never truly leaves. And its opposite number would be Thrushcross Grange, the other dwelling place where the other family, the Lintons, the more refined family, lives. And so the dichotomy, the binary system, is altogether set up. Fierce, primitive, and unschoolable Wuthering Heights in the moors, a place where civilization perhaps cannot take root, cannot take hold, and then a place of order, refinement, leisure, beauty, culture, cultivation, learning, and that would be Thrushcross Grange. These are not bad terms, almost like a set of magnetic poles, and the current that goes between them is, in some sense, the driving sort of energy of this book. The solution that is going to be proposed, and I'll say it now because I'll deal with it later, but even then I won't deal with it too much because I'm not sure that it works. The solution that's going to be proposed for sort of resolving the conflict or the dichotomy or the incompatibility between the raw and the cooked, or between Wuthering Heights and Thrushcross Grange, or between the actors of Wuthering Heights and the actors of Thrushcross Grange, is going to be a generational solution, that the children will maybe carry out the charge of culture through marriage, through softening, through understanding. And so that's sort of the gambit of the book. One of the interesting and I think unanticipated features of the book for most readers is the way that Emily has framed this. And I say it's unanticipated because Emily was fundamentally unschooled. Emily died very, very young. She was sick all her life. She was a fierce soul. In one of the prefaces written to the book by her sister Charlotte, one of the funny moments is when Charlotte more or less queries out loud, how on earth could Emily have known the things that she knows in this book? How could she have grasped the kind of grisly, grim, ferocious nature of these people when she seemed to know so little? She seemed to be bedbound and housebound. How is it possible that she knew? And it's a good question. I mean, of course, we don't know how Shakespeare knew what he knew either. So you don't anticipate that this unschooled girl, I mean, not unschooled, she had some education, some learning, but how this rather unsophisticated young woman would give us a rather sophisticated narrative structure. And in particular, what I'm alluding to is the use of several different narrators who were at some distance from the events that are going to be related in this book and recounted. The first narrator that we run into is the visitor Lockwood. Lockwood is a man who is a fool. He's an over-civilized, mannered fop. We immediately see that he's posturing, that he represents the kind of excess of refinement of civilization. His language seems to be that way. His thinking seems that way. He seems to be a rather shallow, brittle type, and he comes from London to rent Thrushcross Grange, which is well beyond the time that the events that are central have taken place. And in Thrushcross Grange, he meets Heathcliff, who lives there. I'll talk a lot more about Heathcliff as I go. He's one of the central players. What I'm really trying to get at is that Lockwood is, from every point of view, as a Londoner, as an over-civilized fop, utterly sort of unqualified, incapable of understanding the story that's going to be related, that's going to be told. In other words, what kind of grasp would this man have of Wuthering Heights? And yet, he is going to be initiated into its horrors, into its dark truths, and it will come through dream and hallucination. He spends the night in Wuthering Heights, and he has some strange dreams, and I want to quote you some of this. That he's lying in an oak closet, and he dreams, and he hears the wind and the snow, and he hears a fir bough sort of beating against the window, he thinks. And so this is still in the dream. He opens up the casement, he is trying to stop this noise that's keeping him, that's bothering him in the dreams, and he's knocking actually his knuckles through the glass in the dream. And as he reaches out in the dream, his fingers close upon the fingers of what he calls a little ice-cold hand. And you then know that you're sort of in funny territory of the Gothic here. And he tries to take his arm back in, but the hand, this little ice-cold hand, clings to it. And there's a voice that sobs, "Let me in, let me in." I mean, this is an unusual way to start a novel. It's like there's a ghost that's there that has to come in. We think of ghosts as having to get out. This ghost has to come in, and this ghost has to deliver itself of the story. I want to call this is like the ghost of narrative. This is like a ghost that cannot be naysayed. This reminds me of the Ancient Mariner. who has a story that must be delivered, must be told. And the voice says that its name is Catherine Linton. We can't know at this point who that is. It's a lost child. Well, this is already fairly strong stuff, but watch the way this continues to go. As it spoke, I discerned obscurely a child's face looking through the window. Remember, he has knocked out the window pane. Terror made me cruel, and finding it useless to attempt shaking the creature off because it won't let go of his hand, I pulled its wrist onto the broken pane and rubbed it to and fro till the blood ran down and soaked the bedclothes. Still it wailed, "Let me in." To me, this is one of the most really stunning and sickening notations in literature. I mean, just think about it. I have trouble getting my head around all of that. To rub a child's wrist on a broken glass pane. To rub it. I mean, this is a moment of extraordinary cruelty and sadism. And this gesture is done by this quite civilized narrator, Lockwood. It's like automatically this book wants at the very beginning to show you, look what's underneath this proper surface. Maybe that's what dreams are about. Freud was going to theorize all of this later. Is it what is latent inside of us, what's repressed inside of us, what might be called the id or whatever term you want to use for it? This obviously manifests itself in dreams, but this dream has a lot of very specific qualities, and in particular, it's about the abuse of a child. This child, that I've said, is the ghost that wants in. It's the ghost of narrative in some sense. It gives a kind of ghoulish flavor to this novel. I mean, this is like an inversion of the invocation to the muse from ancient literature that the writer asked, you know, that the muse will come and somehow inspire him. And in this case, it's this dead child or a child that cannot die that's banished into being a ghost that continues to haunt. It is a haunting and wants to come in. It's also a glimpse of the sadism, the substantial amount of sadism that is going to come. Because I'm going to be arguing that it's possible to see this entire novel as a story of abused children, of childhood as a time of abuse. Well, if Lockwood is one of the narrators, the other major narrator that we encounter early on is a woman named Nellie Dean. She is a shrewd woman of common stock who has served these families and has witnessed this story firsthand. So you would think, well, she's going to be a reliable narrator. She's someone who was there. And of course, that's what reliable narrator means. And of course, the term is used usually because we realize they're not so reliable after all. And in fact, if somebody was there, does that mean that they understood? Now, Nellie Dean is an interesting figure. She's not a fop like Lockwood. She is a remarkably low-to-the-ground, commonsensical, shrewd figure. And I say that to raise the question as to whether such a person, just like I raised it for Lockwood, is capable of understanding the events at Wuthering Heights, or the people at Wuthering Heights, or the things that they did at Wuthering Heights. And specifically, Nellie is going to be our conduit, because she's the one who is going to tell most of the novel, the story. She knew these people. She's going to recount the story to Lockwood. That's how we get it. So that's why I said this is a pretty sophisticated framework for a novel written by someone who only wrote one novel. I think it's not unfair to say that Nellie gets a lot of things wrong in this book. Frequently, she will construe as posturing the activities or actions or gestures, desperate gestures, of characters which are not posturing at all, which have a kind of gruesome sort of seriousness and unfakeness to them, if I can use that word. So it raises the question of whether this commonsensical figure could possibly take the measure of what she's telling. And I want you to think about how much interesting sort of energy and electricity is in that. Melville uses this model all the time. I'll refer to it a little bit in later lectures on Moby Dick, but in stories like Bartleby the Scrivener or Benito Cereno, it's the same thing. What an interesting formula to have someone tell a story that he or she doesn't fully understand. because the reader then negotiates between these positions. Some people have called this model also the seer-scribe model, that you've got a seer, someone who has these extraordinary visions, who is possessed of some demonic knowledge, perhaps, and then you've got a scribe, some other person at some distance from this figure, whose job it is to, in a sense, translate these findings and make them available to us. You could argue this is the mediation of literature itself. It is the bridge between us and events at which we were not present. And if you think about it, it's a very, very usable model. I think you could talk about a novel like The Great Gatsby that way, that Nick Carraway is our conduit to Gatsby. Or in one of Faulkner's great novels, Absalom, Absalom, Quentin and Shreve are our conduit to Sutpen. It's as if certain kinds, and we will see that Ishmael may be thought of in Moby Dick as a conduit to Ahab. So it's an interesting narrative formula, and again, that's what Bronte has come up with. Well, let's get to the story itself. Nellie's story revolves around the Earnshaw family's history of long ago, well before Lockwood arrived on the scene. Turns out that Mr. Earnshaw, the father of Hindley and Catherine, goes on a mysterious visit, without telling anybody why, to Liverpool and returns with an even more mysterious item, an orphan child, Heathcliff, whom he adopts into the family. Just happens like that. He says that he saw this child starving in the streets of Liverpool. Who is Heathcliff? People have been asking this question ever since this novel has been talked about. Some people have said, and my description might have already suggested it to you, that maybe this is Earnshaw's illegitimate son. I mean, after all, he goes off to Liverpool and he comes back with a little baby. But there are tons of references, not tons, but there are a number of references in the book about other sort of origins for Heathcliff. Maybe he could be a gypsy. He's called a Lascar. He's called black. He's called American. Nellie once calls him that you may be descended from exotic royalty. And some critics have said, well, actually, if you think about the English-Irish relationship, he represents the Irish. For me, that doesn't make a lot of sense. Nonetheless, he represents the other. And there too is a sophisticated narrative formula. Take this child who is totally different. He's called a dirty, ragged, black-haired child speaking gibberish. Take him and stick him into a family, and you've got a kind of ticking narrative bomb about what kind of results are going to come from this. Well, whatever his origins are, he is roundly despised by the older sibling, Hindley, but he forms a remarkable relationship with the feisty girl, Catherine. It's a kind of fusion of souls, it's a kind of kinship that seems to go beyond flesh. They play together all the time. They are inseparable, and you will see that I mean that word quite literally. They spend their days in the moors playing. They are wild children in some sense, children of nature. Now, the plot moves along in this book at a moment when the two children sort of make an excursion over to Thrushcross Grange, where the Linton, the more refined Lintons, live. And this is when the nature culture battle starts to move into higher gear. It turns out that Catherine is injured as they're spying on the Lintons, and she is taken in by the family because they are neighbors, they know each other, and Catherine comes from decent stock. She's an Earnshaw. The family thinks that Heathcliff is absolutely worth nothing. They even make a joke. They suggest that he should be hanged. A lot of brutality in this book. It's everywhere. But they do feel like they should take care of Catherine, and she stays there for 5 weeks as they sort of take care of this injury that she's had from a fall. When she returns home, she's a different girl. She returns home. The text says she's no longer the wild, hatless little savage, but now she's a very dignified person, and her older brother Hindley is quite delighted with the transformation. Of course, the person who's not so delighted is Heathcliff. Heathcliff has had nothing but contempt for these wimpish Lintons with all of their civilized manners. He and Catherine have had a kind of special relationship, a kind of wild relationship in the wilds. And so he feels that he has nothing to worry about from these others. But it turns out that the new Catherine who returns home, who's a bit of a little lady, she begins to give him a kind of class consciousness of his own possible inferiority. And he's got enormous pride, which is now injured from this sense. He thinks that their lives are artificial, the Lentons, but nonetheless, he can see that Catherine herself is drawn to it, and drawn to it to the point that perhaps she's going to reject him. And of course, the spice is added to that by the fact that the Linton boy child, Edgar, has already fallen in love with Catherine. And so this would be Heathcliff's antagonist. Well, all of this is going to have enormous repercussions, it will turn out. The catalyzing event in this book, and I'll spend the rest of the lecture talking about this event, and in a sense, it's a fairly conventional thing because, I mean, novels are filled with moments where someone is listening at a door and overhears something, or somebody spies in a window and sees something, and you think to yourself, you know, life isn't like that. That's really not how we always learn about things. Books frequently rely on that kind of embarrassing way of getting information across, and this one does too. So sure enough, here are Catherine and Nellie Dean having a conversation, and Heathcliff is going to be hearing it. They don't know that he's there. He's in the other room. Catherine assumes that he's outside or somewhere else. He's not spying. He's not really trying to overhear it. It just so happens he's within range to hear it. And they're talking about dreams. Dreams play a large role in this novel. It's as if it says something about Emily Bronte's interest in not just the oniric, but the supernatural, the world that's beyond the kind of material, empirical, measurable world that we think of as reality. And that's why there is a kind of strong romantic dimension to this text. And she talks about heaven, and she shocks Nellie by saying that she would be miserable if she were in heaven. And I'm going to want to talk about that for a minute, too. And, of course, Nellie has a predictably, I think, moral reaction, which is, you're such a naughty little girl. And she is naughty. She's extremely feisty. She's hard to manage or control. The father is dead, so she's been more or less brought up by the older brother, Henley. And she's not really being brought up at all, up until the visit to the Lentons, where she becomes more civilized. Up until then, she's really been a kind of native child, you know, in the wilds with Heathcliff. But she tells Nellie that if I were in heaven, she says, you know, I wouldn't be happy there. And of course, as I said, Nellie says, well, that's because you're naughty. All sinners, Nellie says, every sinner would be unhappy in heaven. That's not it. She says, I had a dream. I had a dream once that I was there. Oh, this gets more interesting now. What kind of a dream was this? Nellie, again, commonsensical Nellie, I don't want to hear anything about dreams. Dreams aren't real. But of course, this is a novel. You're going to hear the dream. I was only going to say that heaven did not seem to be my home, and I broke my heart with weeping to come back to earth. And the angels were so angry that they flung me out into the middle of the heath on the top of Wuthering Heights, where I woke sobbing for joy. It's a marvelous reversal of what we think of as the kind of traditional dogma. We sob when we are kicked out of heaven, or kicked out of Eden, if you wish, because we have lost our place in paradise. On the contrary, heaven is a foreign, alien place. Heaven is not a place where you could be happy. She weeps for joy because she has been sent back to the heath, to the natural world, the world of elements, and of course also to Heathcliff. And Nellie is interested in whether Catherine is now drawn to this little boy, Edgar, who's so wild about her. And Catherine is no fool. She knows that. That will do, she says, to explain my secret as well as the other. I've no more business to marry Edgar Linton. He already wants to marry her, even though they're young. I've no more business to marry Edgar Linton than I have to be in heaven. And if the wicked man in there, she's talking about her older brother, Henley, who is terribly abusive to Heathcliff. He likes his younger sister, Catherine, but he despises Heathcliff. He has despised him ever since the father brought him into the family. He treats him like dirt, and a lot of vicious scenes between the two of them. And if the wicked man in there had not brought Heathcliff so low, I shouldn't have thought of it. It would degrade me, she says, to marry Heathcliff now. This is a key line. The child almost says that. And that's because Heathcliff is sort of, has no finesse, no poise, no style. He has none of the veneer of culture. He's sort of a ragged, sort of urchin child, even though he's allowed to live with the family. Hindley gives him nothing. And so that's what she means. It would degrade me to marry Heathcliff now. So he shall never know, Catherine continues, he shall never know how I love him. And that, not because he's handsome, Nellie, but because he's more myself than I am. I want you to think about that line. I'm going to come back to it because there's another speech in a moment that has even more of that. Whatever our souls are made of, his and mine are the same. And Linton's, that's Edgar's, is as different as a moonbeam from lightning or frost from fire. Emily Bronte just has an absolutely surefire gift, instinct, for invoking the natural elements to describe human feelings. Heaven is rejected here as a kind of pious, inhospitable artifact. But the Heights, Wuthering Heights, raw nature, that's home, where Heathcliff is. It's a new kind of fierce Eden. It's a fierce view as well of human connection. Because Heathcliff is more myself than I am, she says. I think this book is about reimagining paradise. And it also asks, doesn't say it directly, but it's implicit in everything I just read to you. What kind of heaven would there be if I was there by myself? Could that be heaven? Well, Heathcliff has overheard this, but, and here is the kind of gimmick, he has listened only to the point where she says, it would degrade me to marry Heathcliff now. This hurts his pride so much that on a dime, he turns, he gets up, he leaves, and he leaves. He really leaves. He's not to come back. He doesn't hear the rest of the phrase where she says that she loves him more than herself. And so the plot of the novel is going to hinge on that, that it's a misconception. Well, he leaves, but she continues talking. And I want to read you the remainder of her words to Nellie. Nellie understands nothing, but you will. It's one of the greatest speeches in English literature. What were the use of my creation if I were entirely contained here? What she means is, what would it mean to be me if it was only me? Why would I have been born if I was contained only in myself? My great miseries, this is a little girl speaking, a young girl, my great miseries in this world have been Heathcliff's miseries. And I watched and felt each from the beginning. My great thought in living is himself. If all else perished and he remained, I should still continue to be. And if all else remained and he were annihilated, the universe would turn to a mighty stranger. I should not seem a part of it. My love for Linton, because she does, she is fond of her, of Edgar. My love for Linton is like the foliage in the woods. Again, these natural images. Time will change it, I'm well aware, as winter changes the trees. My love for Heathcliff resembles the eternal rocks beneath, a source of little visible delight, but necessary. And then the great, single, simple, elemental line, Nellie, I am Heathcliff. Such a line. Nellie, I am Heathcliff. He's always, always in my mind, not as a pleasure, any more than I'm always a pleasure to myself, but as my own being. It's the grand utterance that she is Heathcliff, that the two of them are bonded. It's an umbilical picture of human beings in which individuation itself would be a mirage. The contours of I are erased here. The contours of a being that has edges are erased. It's like Siamese twins. Now, you may think that this is a very romantic utterance, I am Heathcliff. We're going to see that this is a tragic utterance. And I want you to reflect on that. What does it mean to deeply believe, to know, in fact, that you are somebody else? It doesn't mean that you're not you, but it means that you are also somebody else. It is the end of agency. It's the end of hegemony. It's the end of any sense of self-ownership. It is a horrible kind of openness and vulnerability. And the remainder of the novel and my next lecture are going to deal with just those issues. Thank you.